This Do Lectures episode features former head of design at Nokia and designer and co-founder of Umata Inc., Rhys Newman, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2016.
Thank you very much. I left Los Angeles, what day is it? It's Thursday. Left on Tuesday. And my co-founder, Julian, founded Umata with, said to when's your presentation? I said, it was first thing Thursday afternoon. He said, oh, great, you'll be good to get out of the way because you're a bit punchy and you would travel. And he said, is anyone on before you? And he said, yeah. I said, yeah, Mr. Bingo. And he goes, you're fucked. And he's absolutely right. I started a company called Umata. And as you heard, we're making the first GPS analog speedometer for your bike. And when I describe that, most people say, oh, that's a bit niche. I think Mr. Bingo said that on the way in. It started in 2009. And previously to founding Umata, I was head of advanced design for Nokia. And essentially, I haven't given any presentations about anything since I left Nokia, but just wanted to give you a very kind of simple history of how it came about. I believe there's a loose theme for this weekend, which is about curiosity. And Umata started with me being very curious, but started with drawings. And so I just thought I'd show you the drawings and how it evolved and some things. And so here we go, see if it works. But maybe to kind of give a curiosity is at the heart of kind of how Umata started, but then also it's important to know the context within which kind of those ideas came about. And so 18 months ago, as I was exiting Nokia, I'd been there for 14 years, moved my wife to North America 14 years ago. She was 5 months pregnant. And I'd spent 14 years, started as a designer, moved into kind of managing teams, ultimately kind of was asked to lead advanced design and then became some title VP of some business group that doesn't really matter anymore because the things never got shipped. Most of the time, as I kind of left being a designer, I was completely convinced I was promoted to my level of incompetence. Because I started as an artist and a designer, which is ironic now because I'm a co-founder and apparently a CEO of a company, which I started. But essentially, I led that advanced design team and the business group, and we were a small design team inside a company that for maybe the latter 9 years was in a massive decline. And we were a team on the West Coast. We had designers, multidisciplinary team, in Los Angeles and in San Francisco. And in that time, I'd gone through kind of being in a company that used to be an extraordinary growth and was printing money effectively, and then just because of a small company on the west coast of California just started going a phenomenal decline. It didn't matter. We were still a design team. And in a way, we kind of grew, and it was probably the happiest place I've ever worked apart from Umata. And as I grew from being a designer and then being responsible for kind of designers, my obsession and my responsibility was to create the conditions with which kind of brilliant people could do great things. And as I said, the last 3 years of my time at Nokia, we were asked, like once all the Nokia mobile phone designers had left, I don't know if you know, it was acquired by Microsoft, we were just one of two small teams of designers left in the company. And we were asked to develop a whole range of products that we spent 3 years developing them, and sadly they never got shipped, the business was closed, and we were all made redundant. It's not a sad story because that's the start of kind of the catalyst of how I started or had the confidence or the conditions to start Umata. But essentially, at the end of my time of leading that design team, I wrote an article, and I never write. I'm very shy. I don't often put kind of my opinions out there. And we published it on Medium, and essentially it was said, no dickheads. And it was a guide to creative, healthy, happy, creative teams. And that's something I'd been obsessed with for those last kind of 3 to 5 years, creating those conditions. And there's obviously a perpetuated myth, particularly on the West Coast, kind of technology companies that kind of great visionaries build great products and great things. That's bullshit. Like great teams build great products. And I think what it is, you know, my obsession was trying, like, what are the pragmatic and the practical conditions and the things you can do to create environments where people go first. I loved working there because if like people walk in and it's a healthy, happy environment, then they're productive. And those kind of, it wasn't rules, it wasn't, it was just kind of guidelines and things we learned, and they were very simple and very obvious. And they were like, you know, the polite things, like you should say good morning and say good night when you enter a studio, just kind of announces you're there and you're ready to contribute. Good studio builds walls, put work up, put work out, and you just see in the background here, and this was a studio in LA. Essentially, if you create an environment where you walk into a studio and people can feel and see that what you're building, irrespective of whether it's digital or physical or, you know, whatever part of the business is in, if there's strategy going on, if the work is up and the work is out, people become collectively responsible for it. They all think they can contribute. Don't have meetings in rooms. And it's just we created this whole list of kind of this guideline. And you can go, and it was published on Medium. I said very shy about putting it out there. And I think within a few months, it was like the number one Medium article for about 10 weeks. And 25,000 people have read it and published it. And only one negative comment so far is that there's no ladies in the picture, which is not true. There were ladies in it, but we just happened to have the pictures. But essentially, one of those, the core beliefs that we had and one of the behaviors that we kind of instigated was fringe projects. And like everybody should have a fringe project. Everybody should have a passion. And everybody should have something that they're working on beyond what they're doing. And we used to, you know, in a big corporate environment, in a healthy, happy team, you know, you have to assign like what people are working on. And essentially, we just had the five percenters. And they were the work that people did. And for me, that was drawing. And so I consider myself an artist because I can say it. And I went to art college. But like my role in Nokia, as I've moved into kind of maybe a more, I suppose, managerial or responsibility, I used to draw. I used to have to sit on meetings. I was on the West Coast, and we were part of a leadership team that was in Finland or Berlin. So I used to spend an enormous amount of time sitting on conference calls, sitting in meetings, and it, you know, it sucks your soul most of the time. And so I just started drawing again. And so it was a prolific time for me. You know, I just started drawing more and more. And so I used to do drawings in HR meetings. This is the head of HR talking about healthcare, oddly, in North America. This was another reorganization meeting, head of strategy and reorgs. Here's some colleagues, and this is a product planning meeting. And for me, drawing is kind of, it's not just illustrating, it's also just kind of, from my background is designing, just more explorative drawings. And I just started to try to do these drawings that kind of, what's a little mechanism or an object that kind of expresses what it feels like for a good idea. And then just had the drawings are completely nonsensical, but just exploring ideas that came into my head. And then also at times, you know, if you work in a big corporation, somebody's going to ask you at which point, like, is your team innovative? Particularly if you run an advanced design team. And how are you going to measure innovation? How do you quantify innovation? So for me, it was just, well, you'd measure it. Maybe do some calipers, see how big it is. But essentially, my passion beyond designing has been cycling. So I ride and I race competitively. And I've always ridden. And as I was drawing this kind of time and my kind of side project, if you spend enough time on a bicycle, either commuting and riding in London or in LA, there's certain things you start to see. And so I started to illustrate this, and with a friend of mine, Brian, started to catalogue the grandly titled Universal Truths of Cycling. And essentially, these are just the things that you start to experience. And so there's a universal rule, flat tires always come in threes. You always get three punctures. If you have one, you know another two are coming. So there's three, and they're like magpies because they always come in threes. Meteorological anomaly, headwind all ways. How does it happen? Or headwind both ways. Mysterious overnight flats. When you kind of wake up in the morning, you have a flat tire. It's these little bastards going out there with some nails sticking them in your tires. There's something called cyclist lung, which is when you pass another cyclist. Every cyclist takes a deep breath so that you can confidently just go, good morning, as you go sailing by someone. But it was about this time, so we'd been cataloguing these for about 2 years, and what's important, this is still running in parallel with me kind of leading advanced design for Nokia, is that I read an article by a cognitive scientist from Arizona State University, and he'd written an article about, from a human cognition point of view, 80 miles per hour is a beautiful pace to travel through the world. And it's something simply not movement, not on a bicycle. And I just found that interesting, and started to think about it and reflect on it and started to do these strange drawings. Because it's interesting, if you talk to lots of cyclists and road cyclists, and sort of dependent on how fit you are and where you're riding, but if you say to a cyclist, like, what's a nice pace to travel? You know, what's comfortable when you just go for a ride? A cyclist will tell you, I don't know, 17, 18, 90 miles per hour. And that's interesting. So, and that's, you know, for me, my passion for cycling and my love of cycling isn't necessarily just about fitness, it's about going away and traveling through the world. And I realized that there was a correlation, one between kind of how I experienced through the world and the benefits and pleasures of going out on a bike, and then this kind of cognition. So I started to do these drawings. essentially were just to look at like little analog things and just had these ideas. Wouldn't it be nice if a bell went off when it was 80 miles per hour? It wouldn't be, but you could draw it, and wouldn't it be nice to have a little zoetrope in then? So this was, first drawing was done in 2009 that I read that article. And these drawings just persisted on the fringe. I said, as I was leading and my responsibilities got greater in Nokia, it just perpetuated. And so I just kept drawing this thing, zoetropes and little speedometers. And then it went sideways, just started drawing little windmills and more zoetropes. And it just perpetuated, just kept going on the background. And it was never an idea that I would found a company. It was never an idea to do anything with it, apart from just these kind of little fringe ideas. To prove it, I think this is in 2009, this is my desk in the studio, and I think there's, you know, so these are the catalogues. I think one of the other universal truths of cycling is that you find shit. So these things here. If you're in London, you find money often, because people get in and out of taxis and they're drunk, in the particular junctions you can find money. In LA, you find tools, because there's lots of contractors in pickups, and when they go around the rough roads, it all bounces out, so you can collect clothes and tools. But just importantly, on the fringe, so in 2009, there's a small box there, and that's the only analog speedometer that you can buy. And so I just became obsessed with these. And for 6 years, this idea of a speedometer for my bicycle just perpetuated, just stayed on the side. This is in, I think, 2 years, so this is 2013. And so the person taking the picture is my co-founder, Julian, and we'd sat next to each other in Nokia for about 6 years. And then just showing it as a point, like on the far right-hand side there, there's two drawings of an analog speedometer. And it's a good question, and people have asked us. So you first drew it in 2009, and it wasn't until 2015 that you actually started. And so it's important, like, what happened between those in that time. And to some degree, I probably wasn't ready to do it. I didn't have the confidence to do it. I didn't even know what it was. I knew that there was an idea for a product. I'd obviously been, the conditions that I'd been in with Nokia is I'd spent many meetings and many time, a huge amount of time going to meetings and trying to convince people, an enormous amount of creativity, you know, with designers to try and convince people to see the world the way we wanted to see the world, to share our opinion, ultimately to make the decisions that we wanted them to make. So I used to have to go to Finland every 6 weeks. In that time also, so within the advanced design team, we were asked essentially, as Nokia was in a kind of somewhat of a decline, to do a huge body of work to say, what could Nokia's point of view be? So a kind of a transformation. And in that time, you know, we're all responsible for it, or we see it, is that essentially all the smartphones that we have now are designed for your maximum attention. You know, from a UI, a UX point of view, people are designing apps, designing experiences, making a call, sending a text message, as if the only thing you're doing is paying attention to that phone. Nothing else. And we all know this. You know, the results is we all sit in restaurants, or you know, you see people, couples sitting in restaurants, looking at their phones, not being with each other. And essentially that work had gone, and as I was thinking more and more on this perpetuated idea of this speedometer, I realized that if you looked at what was happening also within the world of cycling, that cycling computers are essentially going on that same trajectory. And the entire industry is going exactly the same way that smart devices and phones and mobile phones have gone. They're designed more and more for your maximum attention, more features, more apps, more things, to a point where all your attention is focused on that, not the primary task. And there's a like, proper science behind how you design these things. And I realized as kind of Nokia, my time at Nokia was coming to an end, that essentially the product I was building, or the idea I had for an analog bike speedometer, was something in complete opposite to the way that the rest of the industry was going. And essentially, my time at Nokia was, I had this clear idea. And fortunately, I had a partner, Julian, who sat next to me in Nokia, who had the same belief. Essentially, there's an opportunity to create an entirely new product. And essentially, a product that was left behind to some degree. Kind of, we all had analog speedometers when we were kids on our bikes. And there was something so fundamentally beautiful and emotional about the faster you ride, the higher the hand would go. But interestingly, we could make a very advanced product. And it's an advanced, so on the outside, it's a beautiful analog speedometer that just does four things. It shows speed, distance, ascent, so how high you climb, and time. And they're based on simple things like you get to an end of a ride or halfway through a ride, and it's like, how far have we been? How fast did I go? How high have we climbed? And how long is it until I got to get home? And so there's an opportunity, and we saw it, but that it doesn't mean that it's not a modern thing. And so even though I come from a design and art background, my time in Nokia and being around kind of very advanced technologists, my partner Julian, we realized that we could make a very advanced thing. So on the inside is a GPS computer. It's kind of as advanced as any other kind of bicycling computer. But the point is that for me, cycling is about going out and getting away and riding. And so if you go back to that, kind of the primary task when you're riding your bike is riding your bike. The primary task isn't looking down and seeing whether I have a king of the mountains, whether I'm competitive. It's like whether you get a text message. Like increasingly, our time is dominated by kind of, you know, networked, connected products. And fundamentally, Julie and myself, and the reason we founded Ometer, we don't believe that advanced things need to be feature-driven. We don't believe that advanced technology needs to always be have a screen with apps and a display. Essentially, advanced technology and our product is about kind of primary task, ride your bike. But at the same time, if you want to capture all that data, if that matters to you, if you want to connect it to the, that can all happen. And I think fundamentally for us, there's an opportunity to do a very emotional product that's quite rational. And so at the end of my time at Nokia in 2015, so 18 months ago, we had this idea. That's what it looks like now. And so we set up shop in Julian's back garden. How do I get this going? So this is the first day, you know, first day after 14 years in a corporate environment. No salary, no healthcare, 3 kids, 8 chickens, 1 wife. Holy shit. Fear, absolute fear. But essentially, we had such a clear idea. What we knew we needed to do was start to build a product, and we used very simple developing the product at the same time. We used Instagram as the place that we could build community. And we did 3 things, and we obsessed about 3 things. One was showing beautiful pictures and films of people riding their bikes, because essentially everybody wants to be out there and ride a bike. So we wanted Ometer to be associated with a beautiful image of riding a bike. Number 2 was just to increasingly show the products themselves. And we were terrified that somebody would launch something similar in the time we were going to do it. So we just stepped closer and closer and took a while to reveal the product. And number 3, we just started to show the people and friends that we were making along the way. So we were outside of the cycling industry. We had no experience kind of working within that world. But very quickly started to realize that there were a group of people that had similar beliefs as us in terms of the priority of riding, also the approach to technology. And we had people, you know, saying, thank you, finally, there's another product. And just people can't wait. So we launched a Kickstarter, as you do, in May of this year. And so we reached our goal. The goal was 150,000. We flew through the goal in 42 hours. And just built a community of maybe kind of 8,000 equally obsessive, passionate cyclists. And essentially in, I think one of the, there's a kind of, ooh, is that, just to finish then, there's, in my time at Nokia, you know, people say just like, why didn't you do it earlier, or what did you learn? I realized looking back that my time at Nokia, I'd obsessed about not only creating those conditions that creative people can excel, but there's, you know, maybe to finish on, there's a T.S. Eliot quote, you know, between the idea and the act, between the thought and the action falls the shadow. And I think I'd realized that my entire kind of design career, I was obsessed about that shadow. Like, why does the shadow fall when we lose sight of things? And the shadow can fall emotionally, and the shadow can fall kind of because it's complex. And one of the most liberating things in founding Ometer is that the shadow doesn't fall so much, like the speed that we can make decisions. There's different things. Fear is a big thing. But essentially, the shadow for us is, you know, I don't have to fly to Finland anymore to ask somebody permission to call it Ometer. I don't have to fly to Finland to ask somebody whether we should do it white or grey. There's 2 of us in the studio, and we make decisions incredibly quickly. And it's been the most exhilarating, scary, wonderful ride. And that's where we are now. So essentially, we started in January 2018. It took us 6 months to kind of figure it out. We had to raise some money, but then we kicked off proper R&D, and we made the first functional prototype of this very advanced, complex thing within 6 months. Launched it in May, successful Kickstarter, and now we another few years work to get there. So there's no real conclusions. It's just an honest story of kind of how, on the fringes of my world within corporate designer, yeah, my curiosity for drawing led to me now kind of with a huge amount of vertigo being part of kind of building this new company. So I think that's it.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or, if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out. For our weekly curation of wonder and optimism, sign up to our newsletter by visiting thedolectures.com/newsletter.